Tonight on Arena, the lost albums, seven previously unreleased records from Bruce Springsteen, and season four of The Bear, season three of Squid Game, and a brand new series, Smoke, all up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Bruce Springsteen has never been one to travel light musically, emotionally or creatively. Across a five-decade career, he has amassed a vault of unreleased songs that most artists would kill to have as their greatest hits. With the release of Tracks 2, The Lost Albums, Springsteen cracks open that vault, offering fans not just a few rarities, but seven full albums, 83 tracks of unheard material, a treasure trove spanning decades, styles and stories, from lo-fi ballads to country heartbreakers, to mariachi-infused epics and sweeping orchestral pop. Tracks 2 reveals the depth of Springsteen's unreleased canon. I'm joined by superfans Pat Carty and Lise Hand, who have been listening to the material over recent weeks, and they're going to share their thoughts with us. But first of all, let's hear how Springsteen himself explains what's involved in Tracks 2.
Over a period of time, I built up a small collection of full albums that, for one reason or another, never got put out. We
inhabited. There he is, the man himself, explaining what Tracks 2, The Lost Albums is or are. Pat Carty and Lise Hand, as I say, in studio with me this evening to talk about this mammoth release, it has to be said. One of the first things that struck me, Lise, was precisely that. This is a huge amount of material. There are artists who would be happy if this was their entire output for their career.
It is. It's astonishing. I think, obviously, I only, you know, received the whole the whole thing in the last few days. And I swear, I feel like one of those, you know, those big fuzzy bumblebees that lie stunned on pavements, having kind of guzzled on nectar, except in my case, for once, non-alcoholic nectar. But like, it's literally, I'm just dizzy with it.
Yeah.
And you know, there's many astonishing things about it. The obviously just the sheer size of it, the breadth of genres and types of music that it encompasses. And I think also just the fact that none of this appeared in bootleg. I mean, this is also extraordinary because he really has one of the biggest cache of super fans of all time. And none of this got out. There were rumours of some of the albums, but nothing ever leaked, which is in itself is amazing. So this is brand new, apart from maybe seven, maybe tracks all told. Yeah. And even those are mostly have been reworked.
And the word, that stands out within that description for me in some ways, Pat, is albums. These were actual albums. They weren't just, you know, here's an outtake from such and such an album. Yeah. We decided not to put that song on this particular track or on this particular album. We decided we'd hold off and we might use it somewhere else. No, these were fully formed albums with proper album covers, vinyl print and you know, designed covers ready to go. But Bruce said, no,
yeah, I mean,
that's not going anywhere.
The thing, you're right, of course, but I mean, the thing is that when you get these box sets sometimes from big artists like this, you know, and the only people you could maybe compare them to Bruce to for the amount of stuff he records and doesn't release is maybe Bob Dylan or Prince or someone like that, you know. And you get box sets from those guys, and you're right. And a lot of times you go, ah, yeah, that's all right, but it's a demo, you know what I mean? It's a thing that he was working towards something else. But as you say, these are finished. These are, and in a lot of cases, as he says in the kind of documentary that accompanies this, and in the notes,
where we had that clip that we got was from.
He was very, very close to releasing these. And it's fascinating to kind of listen to him and think, well, what would have happened if he'd released that one at that stage? And where would his career, would he turn out? I mean, there's a thing, there was one thing I was thinking, if he released that instead of Born in the USA, you know, would he be a kind of a Tom Waits figure now rather than a fella selling out stadiums, you know? But they also, the quality of these, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I really tried to find tracks I didn't like on this. And I think there was one I thought was okay.
That's one out of 83
tracks. One song
tracks.
Out of 83 tracks or something like that. Now, you know, maybe when I live with it a bit more, although I have had it for, I have a bit of an advantage here over Lise. I have had it a bit longer.
Because I
took the soup and wrote about it for an English magazine. But it is astounding, as you say.
Yeah.
It is. It is really amazing.
I think it says, I think just getting such a huge haul, I think it also is quite like revealing of him as well as an artist for several reasons. It shows, for a start, that he was massively busy during what everybody assumed was a sort of a fallow period.
In the 90s.
In the 90s, when he was busy rearing his family with Patty. And it turns out that he's working. And it just goes to show that working and writing is breathing to him, that he actually has to. It's not that he wants to, he literally has to. And I think it also, when you look at the range of these albums, it really shows that he isn't really an urban warrior. This is a man who doesn't write about kind of, you know, the sort of cities, boulevards. You know, he writes about dirt tracks and small town America. And, you know, he writes, it's about interstate highways and mountain trails and all the people who populate them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's when you see this in the round, you realise just how good a songwriter he is.
Yeah. And I mean, Streets of Philadelphia, the song for the film, of course, won him an Oscar. And then we have the Streets of Philadelphia sessions. So while I was doing that song, I ran off this other album at the same time, Pat. That's kind of what we're being told, isn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of misdescribed, I suppose, when these things were, as you say, there was so many rumours about him in the 90s, especially because there's maybe one album, I think. Well, there's two at the start, and then there's Tom Joad in the middle of it, and that's about the size of it. And this thing, I think that's 1993.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that right? And there was kind of, you know, people saying, oh, it's his hip-hop album. Because he has beats on it, you know, and synthesizers, but it's not that at all. And I read someone describing it as trip hop. It's not that. It's not that at all, really.
No.
But he just found this new way of writing. This is how he described it. And because, as you say, he's such an incredible songwriter and so prolific that, you know, he goes in to do something like that. Someone rings him up and says, oh, yeah, I'm making a film. Bruce, will you write me a song? He knocks off Streets of Philadelphia and then goes into the studio and says, oh, that's an interesting idea. And, you know, stays in a hotel and writes 40 songs that night or whatever and goes in and records it.
Well, let's listen to one of that. So the album then is called, this missing album
Sessions,
is called Streets of Philadelphia, like that, Street Sessions. And so let's have a listen to a track called Blind Spot. Blind Spot, the title of that track from Bruce Springsteen, one of the seven albums that he has now released as part of Tracks 2, the Lost Albums. Lee's Hand and Pat Carty with me in studio this evening talking about it. You were saying as we were listening to that, Lee's, that you found it interesting. Why did he choose not to release this material? That was one of the things that interested you as you listened.
Yes, I mean, I think, again, this is all about sort of sliding doors, the road not taken. But it's the road not taken very deliberately and intuitively. I mean, these were paths he decided not to go down. And I think it's because he's very much in tune with maybe what his audience and his fans love. And he himself is on the record of saying that he had sort of, around that time, there were sort of, you know, broken relationship albums. There was Tunnel of Love, Human Touch and Lucky Town. And he just thought, not another downbeat, broken relationship album. Now, I actually would disagree, because I think this would have really fitted in really beautifully and not necessarily would have been seen as all of a part. I mean, it's a fabulous album, and I just regret we haven't had years of this, really.
Yeah. And the other side of that is that it did make me wonder, Pat, you know, because yourself and Lee's are both absolute super fans, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah. Will
this become a kind of a material for completists, or can you come to Bruce Springsteen almost new with this new material?
Well, the quality is so high. Like, you just heard it there. And I mean, the other thing, sorry, I was just thinking when he was playing that, like, if he did release that, you know, around 93 and that became, it, as I was saying earlier, it would have changed the whole, that could have been a huge hit album at the time. Well, the Streets of Philadelphia was a big hit.
That sounds like a big pop hit in some ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, it would have fit in with the sound at the time. Like, so if you think of what he did release, I think the next one after that was Tom Joad, which is a very, it's a great record, but it's very sparse kind of, you know, kind of like what you were saying earlier on, Lonesome Highway kind of stuff. But if he'd released that, you know, it would have just, all these things are kind of alternative pathways.
Yeah,
that he could
it
have gone
and
down, you know.
And I should have said too, Pat, this is called Tracks 2. There already exists a Tracks 1.
1998, Tracks 1 was, it was the first time he kind of opened the archive. There's four CDs of various bits and pieces. Myself and Lisa were talking about it outside. I'm a big fan of it. You not so much?
Well, it's not that I'm a big fan, but I don't think it gave us the sort of insights, or, you know, to your great point, you know, whether it's this is a completist thing or whether it introduced new fans. I enjoyed it, but I didn't necessarily connect with an awful lot of the material because I felt it wasn't quite finished. in the way that I'm connecting with some on most of this collection.
You mentioned, can I add, there was other stuff in between that.
Loads
as well.
Of material.
Loads of box sets where he just seemed to, you know, it's just, as someone said in some article that, you know, he'd recorded 50 odd songs for, say, Darkness on the Edge of Town. There was 3 years before Darkness when he couldn't release a record because of a court case. And then there was Darkness and the River and Born in the USA. And they reckon he recorded about 50 songs for each of those. And they reckon at one point he had about 350 songs in the archive, which accounted for 3/4 of all the stuff he'd recorded in the studio. So he'd only released very small amounts.
Yeah, so he was quite selective in what he let actually see the light of day. You mentioned as well, Pat, The Ghost of Tom Joad, and it's this sparse record, and that there is a kind of a real downbeat and empty feel to it in some ways.
It is a beautiful record.
But emotionally it's quite wrought. He was doing that in the mornings.
Yeah.
And in the afternoons, then he went in. Was it with a different setup, a different band? I think it might have been.
There was some different personnel. Yeah, you're talking about one of the albums on this series.
Somewhere North of Nashville.
Somewhere north of Nashville. And it's a kind of a country ass-kicking, night out in Bakersfield kind of a record, which veers from these honky-tonk songs to these kind of last-call heartbreakers. And it's a fabulous record. Yeah. And I mean, it shares a bit of DNA with, I mean, I think he said that at the time his plan was, well, they were all going on the same record. And then he kind of realised halfway through, I know, you couldn't have Youngstown and, you know, Repo Man on the same record. It just wouldn't work.
No.
But I mean, it's just, look, there's always been this roots element to his music, it's a fantastic country record.
Think of Tom Joad and that kind of sparse, emotionally wrought kind of... I'm using the word empty again. That's not quite the word, but you know, bleak maybe is a better word. There's a barrenness about barren.
It's all austere is a good word too.
There's three good words. None of them have been translated for a living.
You
swear I did, wouldn't you?
So that's happening in the morning. Then you go out, have a bite of lunch, a bit of a sandwich, and you come back in the afternoon and you give us a track like this, Repo Man. Could ever be so happy about a Repo Man as that? That is Bruce Springsteen with the track Repo Man from the album Somewhere North of Nashville, which was done in the afternoons while he was making The Ghost of Tom Joad in the mornings.
Just, you know, for the crack, like.
Yeah. And you were saying Lee's great sense of fun in that.
Absolutely. And, you know, another point about this collection is as well is, you know, the producers are on kind of having said that they really haven't fiddled with any of the vocals on this. Like, what we are getting now is really as recorded. Mm. And I think there's a great sense of looseness and spontaneity, and they're just having the crack in the studio. And I love that about it. There's a great looseness to it. And there's just his whole love of the process shines through.
I'm thinking of the other night, and, you know, certainly Bruce Springsteen has never been backwards about coming forwards on his opinions on President Trump. Yeah, Inyo. This is a kind of, I refer to this as the Mexican album in some ways, Pat. You get a sense that he really is in touch with that Mexican American community in California, and that's it's their stories that he's telling here.
Right. Well, let's have a story then. Right. So he's had a farm since the '90s, right? And he was writing some songs set down Mexico way, as the phrase goes, and one of his research assistants who was helping with this said, well, you know, a Mexican championship winning charro, you know, the kind of cowhand, cowboy, has just moved into my building. And Bruce says, oh, Jenny, bring him over. Bring him over to the house. So your man comes over to the house and ends up working for Springsteen for 5 years as a kind of a hand and teaches him rope tricks and how to ride properly and all the rest of it. And then they have Harvest Day festivals in Springsteen's gaff, or I'm sure that's a thing in America. And your man, this charro fella, says, well, I know a great mariachi band. So Bruce says, bring him over, and they come over, and he's writing these songs anyway, and he hears this music. So I suppose it all feeds into this Inyo. I think Inyo is a county on the border in California.
If it's not, it should be.
Yeah, it's a good name. Anyway.
It is.
And so all these, he's got all these story songs. I mean, the one that's been released, Adelita, if I'm pronouncing that right, it kind of reminded me of there's a Bob Dylan song called Romance in Durango, which is set in the same locale. It's a movie. It's a movie script.
Well, like many is a good song. It's like a short story. It's like a movie. Lise.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, you actually raise a great point there, Sean, because I think that this is an album that will get a huge amount of attention simply because of the ongoing feud between Trump and Bruce Springsteen. I was in one of the UK gigs when he popped off on Trump, and it was It was actually incredible because it was like old Bruce, right? It was like the fire of protest was like crackling out of him. And an awful lot of the songs in the set list, which might have lost their sort of meaning and resonance over the years, suddenly became massively more resonance. Yeah. And I think this album particularly, because, you know, he's in one of the interviews he did, you know, he talks about, you know, it's how, you know, disgusting and dehumanizing the current, you know, situation in America is for so many people. And he says, with these songs, empathy is my intent. I'm trying to get people to walk in other shoes. So I have a funny feeling that this album could become a kind of, you know, protest album around this. I think it'll get a huge amount of traction.
I was at the Frankfurt show last week and he was doing the same thing. And I thought when I saw the set list, I don't really like speechifying at that. So what I did was I had a few wheat beers before I went in. And by the time he was doing that before... My City of Ruins. Oh God, I was bawling. Well, he's right.
Let's listen to a little bit of the song from the album. Then this particular lost album is called Inyo, and the track is Adelita. Spilled in vain. On horseback, a carbon full in every sign. Over the blouse cartridges filled a battle at arms. Side by side, battle we rose. There's the mariachi band playing in the background for sure. There are the trumpets of them at any rate. That's the song Adelita from Inyo, one of the seven albums that makes up our album review slot tonight. We normally do three, but Bruce Springsteen makes us have to do seven.
Double fee.
On Tracks 2, which is the overall kind of title for this set of albums, he has the lost albums, seven albums from various points in his career, Pat Carty and Lise Hand with me speaking about them on this Friday evening. I was particularly interested in the story around Faithless, because you think, here's something that, well, why don't I let you tell us what it is, Lise? It's around this movie that never got made, but the soundtrack's there ready to go.
The soundtrack's ready to go. I mean, it was in 2005 when he agreed to provide soundtrack music, songs and instrumentals for... it's an unnamed movie. He hasn't actually told us the name of the movie, but it's described as a spiritual Western, which is based on a book. And he... Again, classic. He wrote and recorded this in about between 2 and 3 weeks as he was kind of, you know, mooching around.
As you do.
And it'll be easy on that basis of that to sort of dismiss it as, you know, a kind of one of the more inconsequential ones. I would say this could be a sneaky one. I think this is a grower. This will grow on people because it's very quiet, but it's very deep and meditative. And I think it's interesting for him as a writer because he's talked openly about his complicated relationship with God and religion and so on. And I think this gave him, to use the, you know, sort of common pronouns, a safe space in which to express, meditate on religion, but do it through a kind of creative medium. And I think that gives it a great freedom.
And therefore the album is called Faithless.
And the album is called Faithless. And the songs are really beautiful on it. They're tender. And I think this is one that will resonate with people.
This is the title track then from Faithless. Then I saw you. I stood in the field. I just wanted to get a flavour of that. And it's particularly Pat Carty, the guitar at the top. It put me in mind of Paris, Texas and the Ry Cooder music. It's not quite as off, it's not off as off kilter as Ry Cooder's music is for Paris, Texas. But Bruce Springsteen clearly. Streets of Philadelphia is an Oscar-winning song, but he clearly knows how to write a soundtrack on the basis of this.
Absolutely, I mean, there's some instrumental stuff on this as well. You mentioned Ry Cooder. There's another, I don't want to keep harping on, but Bob Dylan, there's a soundtrack to Packard and Billy the Kid. There's an Irish act called The Lost Brothers who specialise in this kind of Morricone crossroads atmospheric kind of thing. But I mean, some of the stuff on this, like we were just saying there, there's a thing called All God's Children, which kind of sounds like the records Tom Waits and Nick Cave have been trying to make for the last 40 years. And very well, sorry, I'm not trying to knock them. But my master's hand on this, and I think there's two versions of it, I'm not sure. It's one of the most beautiful things he's ever done. You know, there's a Morricone thing, kind of theme going on. I think the book possibly could be Cormac McCarthy, just at a guess.
Yeah, it sounds possible.
What you were saying about meditating on religion.
You're right,
You know, you also got to keep in mind, see, that's because how he's throwing us off. Maybe he's doing that, or maybe that's what happened with the character. Like that song there, Faithless, I thought that was a kind of a love song, and then goes in, he's trying to touch the hem of his garment, you know. So obviously that means someone else altogether, you know. That I think this is one of the strongest things on it. This is an incredible record, really.
Twilight Hours. I mean, we mentioned the documentary film that was made around this, and there's an archivist, Eric Flanagan, I think is his name, and I think he talks about Twilight Hours as being somewhere between Frank Sinatra and Andy Williams, and I can see the grimace on your face even as I say it, Lise.
We do Barney about this outside. Polite handbags, but this
I'm right.
Of course you are. I find myself, I have difficulty warming to this one. There's just something not quite right about it. I mean, I was facetiously saying it's sort of like seeing, you know, Bundyaki perform Swan Lake or Enya doing teenage
poetry in motion.
Bring it back down to the street stairway.
So, you know, there's something, I don't know, I just can't really relate to the Bruce in these songs. Now, having said that, right, just put it in context, this is very Burt Bacharach. It's late night lizard loungy crooning kind of songs. Yeah. I'm not sure. Having said that, two points I will make. One, I think that one of the songs on it, High Sierra, is probably one of my top three favourite songs on this album.
Yeah.
And possibly even is moving into one of my favourite songs.
On the entire collection or just on this album?
Generally. Yeah. I mean, it's glorious. Great. It's almost like a mini movie in itself. Like something...
It's a noir kind of thing, isn't it?
John Huston or Jim Jarmusch would do. You know, it's populated with a beautiful story. It's stunning. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. And the second point I'll make is... I think this is an album that a lot of artists will cover stuff from.
Robbie Williams could probably make another career.
And I mean, if Frankie was, you know, still around today, there's one song called Lonely Town, and you can nearly hear Frank Sinatra. Yeah. You can literally almost hear him sing this.
I'm not sure if I hear Frank Sinatra in I'll Stand By You, but I do hear that. A crooner isn't the right word, but that kind of old style honeyed voice that you would associate with Sinatra, Andy Williams, and that kind of era.
Exactly. And look, I think it speaks volumes to the man again, because he talks about the Great American Songbook, and he is literally determined to write a page in each single page.
Style almost.
Exactly.
Let's listen to I'll Stand By You. Brief bit of it.
Till morning comes, just close your eyes. I'll stand by you.
I'll Stand By You, the title of the track from Twilight Hours, one of the seven albums that have now been released by Bruce Springsteen as part of this Tracks 2. And by the way, there is a Tracks 3 coming, end of that documentary as well. I didn't mention the very first album, which is an LA session from 1983, I think, Pat, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's a bit ahead of most of this material is the 90s and the early
noughties.
Seems to be,
yeah. 83 is after Nebraska. So Nebraska is the one he recorded at home in his bedroom. And then 83 is a kind of a bridge between Nebraska and Born in the USA. So say something like, my hometown from Born in the USA is on it. And... I think it's a better version than the one that's on Born in the USA. And a lot of B-sides that he used.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, sorry, very quickly, it's interesting that he says in the notes as well that Born in the USA wasn't the record he wanted to make at all. He was trying to do something else. Maybe that's in Tracks 3,
we'll find out what he really wanted to do there.
And by the way, Twilight Hours is absolutely fantastic. Lise is way off there.
And briefly, Pat, you also brought in an envelope with you because people are saying, do I really want to get 8 albums?
Yeah.
You know, am I going to have time to listen to 8 albums? There is a highlights album, which you got on vinyl today.
I mean, this is just great radio. Pat Carty opens an envelope live on radio. So if people want to buy this, and I really think they should, it is quite pricey. There's no getting around.
Yeah, well, seven albums after all.
But even still, it's quite pricey. Now, I'm not trying to knock the people at Sony, and if they find one down the back of the couch and they want to give it to me, that's okay, I'll take it. But what did arrive today on Friday in the post was this envelope here, and within it is a thing called Lost and Found, which is selections from the Lost albums, box set, tracked to. And it's kind of a highlight thing of it.
Many tracks? It's a double album,
20, I think.
20, oh, well, there you 20. Go. That'd be a good taster. Lise, just stars, this is a waste of time. Stars for the overall collection here from you, Pat?
How many can I give it? Is it has to be
five.
Oh, 500. I think this is fantastic.
500 out of five. Maths was never your strong
point. Yeah, and I'll do 4 3/4 because, as I said, I just have my little doubts. But one, I think another great point about this whole thing is, as you've mentioned, track 3 coming out. In an interview, he said he's already recorded a solo album. Mm. There was some fears that he was maybe thinking about this, you know, this was maybe the end of his touring thing.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think he will. Because I don't think he's going to retire while Trump is still in the White House, because he just wouldn't give him the pleasure.
That's if Trump and lets him back in next week.
Well, of course, we'll definitely offer him asylum here.
Yeah,
so we can have a passport. And I think that there will be a clamour to hear some of these tracks live. Like, there's one on the last one, Perfect World, which is Rain in the River, which is absolutely built for that big E Street Band treatment in a stadium. So there's no way this guy can just hang up his guitar yet. No way.
But do you think he'll be back around in the kind of E Street format? Is he not getting on?
It's certainly what we're getting on Perfect World, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, listen, thanks to the both of you for having a really tough time listening to 83 songs.
Oh, yeah, but that was a terrible trial altogether.
Hard work. Somebody has to do it. And as you've both said, I think this is the big E Street sound, really, is what we get from the album called Perfect World and the track Rain in the River. Lise, Pat, thanks very much. And so to our TV reviews, a very neat 3 series is all we're going to look at. There are no 83 tracks involved in this particular set of reviews. We'll be talking about Smoke, Apple TV's new crime series, follows an arson investigator and a detective hunting down 2 serial fire starters in the Pacific Northwest. This is inspired by true events and the hit podcast Firebug. Series stars Taron Egerton and Journey Smollett. Squid Games Season 3, final chapter, they say, of the global phenomenon. It launches on Netflix. Haunted by betrayal and loss, Ji-hun returns once more to the arena, surprise, surprise, where he forms new alliances and discovers dark secrets. More surprises, eh? With the frontman tightening his grip and the VIPs watching, survival is not guaranteed. It is the final season, after all. But first up tonight, we are back in the kitchen with Season 4 of The Bear on Disney+. Carmi and his team face their toughest challenge yet as they try to turn their chaotic high-stakes restaurant into a Michelin star establishment. The clock is ticking, tensions are boiling, and every dish must be perfect. Every dish must be perfect. Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. And when I read that about the Bear, Season 4 of The Bear, I thought, are we back in Season 1? Because that's what Season 1 was all about, wasn't it?
And this is the problem, I think, that people have with The Bear now that we're on a 4th season. Did we ever think we'd made it to Season 4? How much adrenaline do you have in your body left after watching every episode? But I think with Season 3, people were beginning to see, join the dots a bit too much, and you're thinking to yourself, how many times can Carmi as a character let everyone else down? How many times can we see an act of self-sabotage, this high-wire act? You're saying high stakes, high beef. What is going on with this man? He's positively Nietzschean in his self-destruct mode. He's like the rust coal of restaurants, basically.
Although what I remember most about Season 1 is, like, literally, as you say, Jen, being exhausted watching and thinking, why are they all shouting at each other? Can they just stop and have a small quiet conversation, even for just 30 seconds? And in Season 2, I think it kind of pulled back a bit from that, and Season 3 even maybe further. And from what, I only have a clip from it, but there's a sense that in Season 4, perhaps there's a little more conversation going on rather than shouting. Am I right?
Yeah, there's a little less, they've noted the fact that, you know, the kitchen up until now has been quite dysfunctional, but everyone is starting to talk to each other and not just shout at one another. Season 1, I think, was loud. Season 2 was quite beautiful. Season 3 was directionless. And last year's season, and a lot of people were saying the same, and there is a sense that maybe even Christopher Storer, who writes, directs and created this thing, has been listening, that, you know, he was telling half a story, he was spinning plates, he was giving far too much time to, you know, the comic relief, the Fax characters, the Fax brothers. They all of a sudden, you know, went from being, you know, characters on the fringes to, you know, main players. Yeah. And there was a sense as well that it was like, okay, we have these actors for maybe the next year before they blow up, before Jeremy Allen White plays Bruce Springsteen, before A.O. Eddie Berry becomes a movie star. Let's stretch this out as long as we can. And so nothing really happened, basically.
And she will
will become a movie star. AO oh, Ed Berry. Sure. And that dynamic between, because I'm going, the clip that I have is between Sid, her character, and Carmi, Jeremy Allen White. That dynamic has been essential to the story almost from the very start.
It really has. And it's great to see with Io's character, that with Sid, that she is not, it's not about an emotional relationship, as in it's not about will they, won't they. It's about will they, won't they succeed in a partnership, in a business. And it's about a woman being taken seriously and building things from the ground up and wanting a mentor, but also in this season, maybe wanting to surpass her mentor. And that is the problem. This is the issues where we're looking at, where Sid is offered the world on a plate. She could go to another restaurant, or does she want to stay with her scrappy group that she loves?
Egos are big in the restaurant business, they tell me. Let us have a listen to the clip then, featuring Jeremy Allen White as Carmi, Ayo Edebiri as Sydney. Newspaper review has come out and they're having a little chat about what it all means.
I wasn't good enough. And I need to be better.
Okay. I don't know if that's a takeaway.
What's the takeaway?
The Trib ate here three times at three different restaurants.
The food sounded good.
Sometimes.
They didn't like the vibe.
They didn't like the chaos. And yeah, frankly, I don't know if I do either.
You think I like chaos?
I mean, I think you needed to be talented. You would be just as good. You would be great. Maybe even better of, you know, a cook without this need for, like, mess.
Well, congrats, that knocked the wind right out of me.
Well, you don't need it.
Air?
Dysfunction. You're shutting down. I can feel you shutting down. You can feel it in this place. I have no idea, like, where you are.
I don't like dysfunction.
Okay, well, what do you like?
I like this.
Is there a restaurant pianist playing in the background as he says that? The piano music is extraordinary there. In case you don't know that this is sad, here's a hint. Jeremy Allen White as Carmi and Ayo Edebiri as Sydney, Sid, in season four of The Bear. You get a sense even in that clip, they're kind of coasting now towards a finishing line, are they?
Yeah, thankfully. They need to land this. They do not stick the landing on this, you guys. And I think this season, I mean, The Bear is always about time. And, you know, you do have the tagline, let it rip, but also every second counts is the real tagline, I think, of The Bear. And, you know, you open this season with Carmi watching Groundhog Day, and it's about feeling ground down by his own dream, repeating the same trick every time. So if you grow in this restaurant...
Kind of what the series has been doing as well.
Exactly. And if you're growing the restaurant into a success and you're trying to do something innovative, but maybe the dream is not what you actually want. Like, maybe his dream is different now. The grind is getting to him. And I think Sid is being offered these other opportunities, and it's about, you see her watching Jumpin' Jack Flash with Whoopi Goldberg, and she asks the question, do you want to work here or do you want to live in the film? All so right. These are very important touchstones to the whole story.
Stars from you, I know you're a bit iffy about it, but I get the sense that you still want to watch season four.
I still want to be around these characters, and I'm ready to say goodbye, but I'm also want to give them their due, so hopefully it'll be a good send off. I'll give it 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. What are you saying, Chris?
There is an air of finality about the whole thing, and I think there's a great little narrative gimmick in here where you have Oliver Platt's uncle, who's the main investor in The Bear. He literally installs a clock in the restaurant with 1400 hours on it at the beginning, and at the end of that 1400 hours he tells them, we run out of money, we run out of hope, The Bear will have to shut. And I think that's not just there for the characters, it's there for the audience to let them know that this is going somewhere.
Okay. There is a clock on.
So that's a huge relief. I think the writing is sharper, I think it's tighter, I think finally, as I say, we're starting to go somewhere. 4 out of 5, hopefully it ends well.
4 out of 5 ends well, and it's on Disney Plus. Let us move on then to Smoke. Interesting premise on this particular. Two protagonists, one of them an arson investigator, the other one a detective investigating the arson investigators.
Yeah, that's it. So this is from Dennis Lehane, who gave us Blackbird 3 years ago, which was probably my favourite television series of 2022. You also had Taron Egerton in there. You also had Greg Kinnear. The three of them are on the same team now for Smoke, which takes its cue from a true story, and it also takes its cue from a podcast called Firebug. Yeah. I will say, the less you know about that story and the less you know about the podcast, the better.
Don't Google this.
Do not
Google this.
Don't even look it up on Wikipedia.
People have just doing it. No,
how could you exactly
don't no, it's actually in the Wikipedia entry, it's in the first three lines about what happened, so stay away from that. But Taron Egerton is playing this arson investigator named Dave Goodson, lives in America's Pacific Northwest, and he is investigating. He used to be a firefighter, but after a particularly bad day on the job, he went into the investigation side of things, and he's been following two serial arsonists. He's driven up the walls by the fact that they just can't catch these guys. One of them pours petrol into milk cartons and sets fire to innocent people's homes. The other one has been going in and out of busy supermarkets, putting an incendiary device in crisp packets, and the whole supermarket goes up. Right. So because he's not getting anywhere on this, a detective played by Jurnee Smollett is brought in. She's brought in. She's actually being punished for something that happened on the job to help him solve these
crimes.
And
we'll find out what that is as the series goes on. Let's have a listen to a clip that features that first encounter between the two of them, Jurnee Smollett as this detective who has been sent to investigate the arson investigators led by Taron Egerton. This is a scene from Smoke.
I've been told you could have two serial arsonists working this area.
Well, we keep Metro District detectives apprised in each of the cases. Why send someone else?
Well, you've had one serial arsonist setting fires for over a year, another one for 6 months now, no significant leads on either.
Have you studied arson investigation?
No.
And, you know, I teach it all over the state.
Oh, yeah, your reputation precedes you.
Yeah, you preceded me, too. Into my own office.
I'm sorry, this is awkward. But, I mean, wouldn't you like fresh eyes?
But you just said you don't know anything about arson.
Yeah, but I know a ton about crime scene analysis.
Why send you?
Excuse me?
Well, you seem smart. You got a gold shield at quite a young age. You can't network here. You can't make the kind of flashy busts you can make in narcotics or cybercrime. You got transferred to a box.
I don't look at it like that.
Jurnee Smollett and Taron Egerton there in a scene from Smoke, the new series on Apple. I remember, Jen, I was checking with you when you came in tonight when we did our bank holiday, our June bank holiday programme. We were looking at things that were coming up in the autumn, and you had chosen this as something you were very excited about on the basis of Blackbird that Chris was mentioning there as well. Have you been satisfied so far?
Yes, I have, because I think it's a series that is packed with twists, and including this reveal that happens that I didn't see coming, and it makes very engrossing TV. And I think there are other moments that are signposted in a bit of a boneheaded way, which can feel a bit rote or not as inventive, but it works because it is surprising, but it's pleasurable watching these characters perform and their respective wheels spinning about this case and figuring things out together, and us figuring them out along with them, or maybe a step ahead of them and seeing what they will do. I think Taron Egerton is really good at this very overconfident blowhard, and he's struggling with impotence issues.
And he wants to be a writer as well, doesn't he?
Oh, that is very funny, because initially you hear this voiceover and you're thinking, what the hell is this? This is terrible. Yeah. It's very overwrought. But then you learn it's him, his novel that
he's
trying to write.
I think it's an in-joke because
I think with Dennis Lehane, I think he should be taught in screenwriting, because this is taught. It is so good in that way. And I think Jurnee Smollett, she's electric as this very troubled detective, and she's wondering about her place in the world.
Yeah.
And the two of them like bounce off each other.
I have
in that
to say,
way.
Like, even that's their first scene together. And I was watching it today and I thought, there's so much chemistry between this. They shake hands and you think, whew, there's a lot of sexual tension there.
I suppose
something's going to arise between the two of them as they start investigating each other.
We won't say anything except for the fact that they do spark off of one another very well. And I think people might be watching it. They might watch the first hour and think, oh, this is just another generic cops and criminals thriller. You know, we've seen this done 1,000 times before. You know, Taron Egerton has certainly made things like it. Do stick with it, because as Jen mentioned there, there is a bit of a plot swerve very early on, the kind you will not expect. And it just becomes something else entirely. It becomes suspenseful, genuinely exciting. I think also Dennis Lehane has made a very clever decision to unmask one of the arsonists very early on. So you do get to see this guy named Freddie, played by an excellent actor named Natari Guma Mahabo Mwine. And he is just brilliant as this guy, Freddie, who's socially awkward, crippled with shyness, very, very lonely, works at a fast food chicken restaurant. And he's so unhappy. The only times that he gets any sort of pleasure from life is actually burning people's houses. And you think, despite the fact that you're watching that and you know what he's capable of, he should be horrible. The performance is so devastating.
It's so broken.
Yeah. For the second time, I think, in the Dennis Lehane series, because we got Paul Walter Hauser playing a despicable human in Blackbird, but you still felt sorry for him. So I think his performance, as well as Taron Egerton and Jurnee Smollett, is something to be called out.
And yeah, I think you probably watch this and need to watch this on a big screen as well. I was watching it on a small and it's quite dark.
It is very dark.
I mean, light in terms of the lighting.
Exactly. That's true. It's so got that grayscale to it. But also, I'd say the actual images of the fire are beautiful as well to look at. I think with Dennis Lehane, he's always confronting the worst of ourselves. Yeah. And I think that's what's really interesting, especially the masks slipping. So it's really enjoyable, very engrossing, very engaging. I'm going to give it a four.
A four.
I'm with Jen. And I'd also like to mention a fabulous theme by Tom York at the top. Great stuff from Radiohead's Tom York. Four stars. Loving it so far.
So an album review as well.
Yeah, there you go. That's price of one.
Smoke on Apple TV. Okay, we've one more to go and we'll do that, which is Squid Games Season 3 after these. All right, we've had a brand new series in Smoke. We've had Season 4 of The Bear and now Season 3 of Squid Game. You know, sometimes you should make one season of a programme. Fawlty Towers knew to do it. Make one season and that's it. Squid Game Season 3, it really feels like, yes, they're going to make money and yes, people will watch it, but why are they doing it, Chris?
Yeah, well, I think even the series creator, Won Dong-hyuk, I think he's probably even asked himself, why are we doing it at this stage? Because Squid Game was not devised or designed as a three-part saga.
No.
It wasn't designed as we're in this for the next 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, there were a bundle of people and there was going to be one left standing at the end of all these horrible games where people were murdered and killed.
Yeah, and Ji-hun was the last one standing and he didn't get on that plane at the airport. Instead, he decided to go back to the games to, you know, get his vengeance on the front man and the people behind it. Then, you know, he'd go back into the games to basically get his revenge. I think that was a huge mistake. I think if they had left it at one season of Squid Game, we'd be sitting here now talking about how it was one of the greatest miniseries of the 21st century.
Because it hit us at such a good time as well, a pandemic time, and you felt very close to it. We were all eyes on it. It was like this murderous crystal maze. It felt different, but also had things to say about society, the society we're living in by controlled by oligarchs, thinking about money, thinking about how to survive. Like, it was inspired by, you know, South Korea's household debt and I laid off workers and that urgency and desperation of that.
Am I right in thinking that Season 3, if I looked at it right today, is picking up right immediately after the
straight
events
after
of season
three,
it's almost like it goes into the next. So in fact, seasons 2 and 3 could really have been done as one big long season.
Yeah, but as Chris was saying, because it was the most successful show Netflix have ever had, they split it in two.
Yeah.
And this is what they're doing with Stranger Things as well, except for they're splitting that final season into a million little episodes. Yeah. I think I don't know what's happening with that, but you can understand. He also made a really, I think, tone deaf, a real life game, Squid Game, out of this as well. That was a spin off. And I just think we're tired at this stage. And I also think, really, with this third season, it's asking you, why do you think you'll get a different result from these games? You know what you're in for. Yeah. It's never going to change. So it's asking you, why are you still watching in itself?
Yeah, and is there any new dynamic? You know, we're getting to know those who kind of control. It's not just the big, rich oligarch players who are watching in their ivory towers, but to get the guards who are taking people around. We're getting to know them a little bit better, I think, in seasons 2 and 3.
But is
there a new dynamic coming in at all, apart from a bundle of people who want to win a load of money, but only one of them will, because only one person will be left standing at the end?
There are a lot of new characters in there, characters that were introduced in the first round of this season, I suppose, 6 months ago. It is only 6 months since season 2 was on. But compared to the lineup we had in the first season, they're just cutouts. Like, there's nothing really to explore there. And it doesn't feel like
season was heartbreaking.
When
you got down to 9-10 characters at the end, you're like, only one of these people is going to survive these games.
Yeah.
And how? And it was devastating, particularly in the end sections when you knew the characters and people died.
Well, it was about something. And it was a social commentary then. And it feels as though the social commentary thing has just been pushed aside. And it's like, let's have an hour of people running around this, you know, maze of corridors playing hide and seek. The people who don't make it out are going to be stabbed. Mm. And the people who do make it out just happen to have the
and
right
don't
key.
Say don't it's, kill me, because when you say don't kill me, you'll be killed.
Yeah, it's very tiring. And I know I'm talking about clocks again here, but this was a big problem Robin, but so there's a clock in The Bear, there's a clock in Squid Game. In the second episode of Squid Game, we have this 30-minute chase, we have this 30-minute hide-and-seek sequence. And I was actually thinking at the beginning of it, okay, this might actually be genuinely thrilling. One, the creator actually stretches that 30 minutes out over an hour. Right. It's just too drawn out.
There's a clock on Arena as well, and there's only 54 seconds left on it. So, Jen, tell me, does this season 3 work? Will it finish up? And how many stars?
I think Hwang Dong-hyuk is basically saying that, you know, Ji-hoon in this series, he's not the surrogate for the viewer. You're the oligarch. You're the people that are still watching.
You're watching it.
You're tormenting yourself. So I think we're done enough with this, I think, too.
And what are you saying, Chris?
I think what was one of the most extraordinary shows of 2021 is probably the most forgettable of 2025. So it's 2 stars.
That's fairly clear. Okay, Smoke is available on Apple TV, The Bear Season 4 streaming on Disney Plus, and the final Squid Game is streaming on Netflix, and it doesn't sound as if either Chris or Jen Gannon, Chris Wasser, Jen Gannon, are sad about that final season. Just before we go, lovely text in from Jimmy in Kilrush, County Clare. Have seen Bruce, he's referring back to our reviews of those albums, those 7 lost albums of Bruce Springsteen. He's seen Bruce live 96 times, one of the last greatest rock stars are still performing. If you get an opportunity to hear these live, that would be a brilliant thing. I agree with you here, Jimmy. It will bring a whole new meaning to them and will be absolutely fantastic. I've no doubt we will hear them live in the near future. I hope you're right. Thanks to Jimmy in Kilrush, County Clare, for that. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. John Byrne was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.